Did you change the way you did cover songs, Pete?
We did. Up until this point, we took great pride in learning songs exactly like the record. We'd even memorize the mistakes. We were quite proud that anyone could look at the bass patterns that were being played and they would be perfect. However, with this Joker's Wild group, we started to innovate and we started to change things and we started to combine songs and we started to do some things that we created ourselves. So this was the beginning of where we really started to do some innovation.
Could you give me an example of a cover song that you did some innovations with?
Shake. That song Shake by Sam Cooke. We did that one and we changed it. Lonnie said, let's see what happens when Jimi Hendrix meets Sam Cooke. So we were listening to a lot of Jimi Hendrix and Cream back then, and we started innovating some of that stuff into songs. And then also in Shake, we decided to put in a drum solo. So that's where Pete had his big drum solo in the middle of that song.
Another example would be Born to be Wild and Season of the Witch. We liked both songs, and we had some debate whether which one should be our finale ending song. We ended up doing a medley where we would switch from one song to the other and then back to the original. Couple of examples of how we changed things up a little bit.
What was the one you put the slap echo on?
Gloria. We did, yeah, Gloria by them.
Now, I understand from my notes that on May 12th, 1967, Joker's Wild got in a little trouble playing at a high school prom at the Glenwood Ballroom, thanks to the Rolling Stones. What's the story on that?
What happened was we'd played the first hour, it went great. We played half of the second hour, and somebody came up and requested, do you guys do Let's Spend a Night Together by the Rolling Stones? And we said, yeah, we can do that song for you. So we thought we'd be nice and play the song for them. We played the song, Let's Spend a Night Together by the Rolling Stones. And right after the song was over, here comes the principal up to the stage with a couple of parents saying, you guys can't play vulgar songs like that at our dance. We want you out of here now. It's over and done. Goodbye. And we did not get paid for that show at all.
Pete, what'd you think about that job?
Well, I just thought it was interesting that they would take a band like Joker's Wild and use them as a prom band.
Probably not a good fit.
Not a good fit.
Now, I understand Joker's Wild recorded their first 45 in the summer of 67. How did that come about, and whose idea was it to record the 45?
Dave Anthony came to us and said, you know, if you guys had a record out, we could probably send that out there and it would get you more exposure. You get airplay and stuff like this. That way you could get your price up on playing. So we decided to do a few songs, but we didn't want to go in and do cover songs. Everybody at that time was running into the studio and doing their version of a cover song. So we had written songs. We had our own originals. We started real early because of Lonnie Knight writing songs and saying, hey, I got this, hey, I got that. And Bill Jordan was also writing at the time.
Where did you record your first 45?
We recorded our first 45 at K-Bank Recording Studio in Minneapolis. That was before they changed names a few times. And when we went in, it was a four-track studio. We had set up and we had done All I See Is You, a song written by Lonnie Knight, and I Just Can't Explain It, a song written by Bill Jordan.
Who did the engineering?
Bob Schultz did the engineering back then.
How long were you in the studio for the session, Pete? Do you recall?
3 hours, I believe.
What was it like being in the studio for the first time?
Well, it was exciting for me. It was my first time in the studio, and I just really didn't know exactly what to do or what to expect. But I was a little surprised. There was one microphone for the whole set of drums, and the technician wanted to know where I wanted that one microphone placed.
And where did you place it?
I really don't remember where we placed it, but I do know that one is nowhere near enough to record a drum set.
Were you happy with the sound?
I wasn't happy with the sound, but I think Denny can elaborate a little bit on just the technology of recording and the number of tracks and how they mixed it down.
Yeah, back then we didn't know that what you did was you took your drum track, you took your bass track, you took your rhythm guitar track and your keyboard track. You did those. You laid those down first with no vocals, and you mixed those down to one track. And I remember they called us into the recording booth, and they said, what do you think? And we're going, what do we think about what? And they said, well, we're mixing all these tracks down to one track. Do you like the sound you're hearing now? If not, we have to change things. And we didn't know what was going on back then. We went, well, yeah, I guess this sounds okay. And he says, now, once we do this, we can't change anything. So they had mixed all those tracks down to one track, so that left room for the guitar overdubs, the back-on vocals, and the lead vocals. That would have been the other three tracks, which make up for the four tracks.
Now, your record comes out on the Metrobeat label. What's the story on Metrobeat?
Metrobeat was a label owned by David Anthony Wachter from David Anthony Productions, Mike Jan from the Star and Tribune, and Tony Andreessen from the Trashmen. They had their record label that they put together to help promote bands that were booked through David Anthony Productions.
Did you get any airplay with the first 45?
Yes, it got played on WDGY and more so on KDWB here in the Twin Cities area. And we would frequently hear it as we were traveling around the five-state area to our various jobs. It seems that if we were coming to town, that would somehow get put on the air in the weeks ahead.
I would have to think that would be kind of a good feeling to hear your own song on the radio.
It was. Although we were a little self-conscious of the quality of the record, but we were still thrilled that we were getting airplay.
Looking at my notes, I see that Joker's Wild played for a very large audience at the Majestic Hills Ballroom on July 3rd, 67. What's the story?
Yes, that was in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. We played with the Association and the Five Americans, and it was the biggest crowd that we had played for to date. We estimated there were in excess of 4,000 people there. It was really exciting.
Danny, what do you recall about that?
Yeah, it was a huge show. It was done with a lot of local bands from Illinois, and it was really nice because we were not the opening act. We had like two or three bands before us, and then we played, and then after that, the Five Americans and then the Association. So we were kind of like the mid group, and it was a good feeling. The show went well. I thought everybody played well. It was a happy time. It was great.
Now, I understand the band made a trip to Milford, Iowa, to the Iowa Great Lakes Recording Company studios, where a number of Midwest bands recorded. How did that come about?
That came about by me being really dissatisfied with our first recording. So I had talked to Tim Kerr. Well, actually, I talked to Bill Strandloff, who lived across the street from Tim Kerr, and he says, get together with Timmy. Maybe he can help you out. And we went over and sat down with Tim Kerr, and he said that he would like to take us down to IGL Studios, where he felt it had a lot better recording quality, and that was where DJ and the Runaways did their stuff. Peter Rabbit and Pete Klein Quintet recorded there. So we had set up a date after we played in, I think, Winsted, Minnesota or something like that, to drive down to IGL Studios and do a recording session down there. So we actually booked almost the whole day down there. We had like from 10 till 6 o'clock, and we went down there just to do, I think we were planning on doing about four or five songs, but finding out the process took so long to put together that we only ended up coming out of there with two songs.
Do you recall the two songs?
The two songs were Echo and That Man's Not You.
And who wrote those songs?
Echo was written by Lonnie Knight, and That Man's Not You was written by Thomas R. Smith.
Who's Thomas?
Thomas R. Smith was a college friend of Lonnie Knight's that went to University of Minnesota with Lonnie. And he lived in River Falls, Wisconsin. And he wrote songs for a lot of different bands. And he used to come up with stuff all the time and just submit them. And I think we actually did probably two or three Thomas R. songs.
Did those two songs get pressed up or?
No, those we wanted to release that fall. But due to financial situations, we just couldn't come up with the money to do it. So.
Did you discuss having Timothy D. Kerr manage the band?
We did discuss that, and Tim tried booking us on a few different jobs and that, and it just didn't work out the way we wanted it to. Tim was at that time getting involved with Columbia Records, where he ended up getting a job, and he was booking so many. He was trying to do too many things at once back then. We didn't get a lot of focus, so we ended up going back to David Anthony.
And moving on, what happens next in the life of Joker's Wild?
That fall, Bill Jordan said that he was going to be leaving the band to accept a job with the Joel Hillman Band. He wanted to get back to playing country because that's where he felt comfortable and that's where he was happy. So Bill left the band, and instead of hiring other guitar players and auditioning people, Lonnie Knight grabbed the guitar and he filled in, and he did a fantastic job.
So who's in the band now?
It would be Lonnie Knight on lead guitar and vocals, Pete Huber on drums and vocals, Denny Johnson on bass and vocals, and Greg Springer on keyboards and vocals. We were a four-piece at that point.
Now, I understand in January 1968, the band goes back to K-Bank, now called Universal Audio, and records their second 45. Pete, what's the story?
We booked studio time with Universal Audio, which was formerly the K-Bank Studios, and we recorded four songs. Because I'm Free, written by Greg Springer, Sunshine, Witch, and Copper Penny, which were written by Lonnie Knight, and Tony Andreessen from The Trashmen produced this session for us.
And out of those four songs, which two did you pick to put out on the 45?
We picked Because I'm Free. The Greg Springer song is side A on it, and Sunshine is side B on the 45.
Now, this one I see comes out on the Peak label. Is that connected to Metrobeat?
Yes, it is, but there were so many bands coming out on Metrobeat at the time, we wanted to be separated from that, so we needed a different label. So they came up with Peak, and that's what they put us out on, was Peak.
So having Tony produce this record, did you get a better sound, do you think, this time, Pete?
Boy, I sure thought so. I also got a lot more miking around the drums.
Which more than one.
For me. Yes. And Tony was present in the studio and gave us advice and coached us, and he was a real mentor for us.
Denny, did you think this was a superior quality compared to record number one?
I thought it was better than record number one, and Tony was there the whole time, and it was great to work with somebody who was used to recording.
Now, was Universal Audio still four-track?
Yes.
And when this record comes out, do you get any airplay?
Yes, we had airplay on Because I'm Free on KDWB and WDGY.
How long was Greg Springer in the band?
Greg Springer left the band in February of 68.
So that turns the band into a three-piece.
Yes. And actually, that was where the band functioned the best, I thought.
Pete, did you switch from a single kick drum to a double kick?
Sure. With less people on the stage, we needed to do something to have a presence there. So I went to a double bass drum set, raised my cymbals up even higher than they already were, and spread the drum set out so that it just took up more room and more presence on the stage.
Did you ever go to a triple kick drum?
I did in later years.
How many floor toms and upper toms did you have?
I had four upper toms, two floor toms.
How many cymbals?
Oh my gosh, that was a moving target, but usually I had 5 to 6 cymbals, and several of them were up over 5 to 6 feet in the air.
How were you able to reach those, by the way?
Boy, lots of practice. It started early on when I started getting back and neck cramps from being hunched over the drum set. And we practiced long hours. That's one thing about our band that surprised many, is that we played a lot and we practiced a lot.
Where's the band practicing at this point?
The prison ballroom in Burnsville. We used to practice that in 2204, the basement.
2204 what?
Girard Avenue South. We practiced in the basement there.
Did the band have a band house?
Yes, we used to live at 2208 Girard Avenue South, and then we moved to 2204 next door. What happened was we lived there for a while, and then we got we were doing a lot of stuff on the road where we weren't coming back for a while, so we decided to check out of there, and then when we came back, we asked the lady who was the landlord if she had anything else, and she said she had an apartment opening up next door, so we ended up taking that one.
I believe I heard you shared a house or a duplex with the 19th Amendment at some point.
Yes, that was 1505 Fremont Avenue North. They lived upstairs, we lived downstairs, and that was a unique experience.
How was that, Pete?
Just music was everything. Every part of our day was either practicing, learning songs, listening to songs, or silk screening Joker's Wild t-shirts.
Ah. And Pete came up with the idea of building special amps. So we took these Fender XL cabinets and tore them apart and put black grill cloth on them and had the whole top redone and chrome-plated bottoms with wheels and called them Fender experimental models.
They were exactly 150% bigger than the originals. And when we finished them, they looked exactly like they came out of a Fender factory. So most of the other bands would say, "What are those?" And our answer was, not wanting to lie, we're not allowed to talk about it.
Yeah. And Pete put view meters in all the tops to where you're playing. You can watch this meter go back and forth.
Now, most of the bands are like using equipment on loan from various stores, right?
Yep.
But you're not doing that at this time.
We were not at that time, but that was soon to change.
Okay. Now, Pete, I understand from talking with Denny that you developed a habit of shattering drumsticks quite often.
Well, I didn't do it on purpose. I found that as these guys got bigger and better amps and played louder and louder with the psychedelic music, I had to be working harder to be heard. And if I bought sticks that were too big, I would break the drum heads and break the cymbals. So I settled with a 7A drumstick, but they broke a lot. Pretty soon I was breaking 4, 5, 6 sticks a night. They just got more equipment and louder. So I think there was one night, one of the newspapers in Fargo said I broke 56 sticks that night.
Somebody counted.
Yes. We would buy them by the gross.
Yep. Bought them at Wagner Music for what, I can't remember what the price was, but we bought 144. We used to buy boxes at a time of 7As. And Pete had a certain spot on a cymbal where he'd hit him and it looked like a woodchuck back there with sticks flying all over the place.
So what happens next with Joker's Wild?
Actually, September of 68, we were contacted by Park Music. They were looking for a couple of bands to promote Sun equipment. Sun was a brand new amplifier from out of town that came in and was going to be taken over. And we had signed on with them, and they furnished the entire band with PA and all the equipment. And I think they did the store open at the same time.
Where was Park Music located?
Park Music was located on Louisiana and Minnetonka Boulevard in St. Louis Park.
Okay.
Leo Fine and Mort. Leo and Mort. Mort and Leo. Yeah, Mort and Leo from Park Music. There you go.
Okay. And I understand in late 1968, the band makes a connection with local record producer Warren Kendrick. What's the story on that?
Yes, we got together with Warren to practice for an album that he was going to be producing of all our original material. And we got together with him at someplace else in Robbinsdale. It was a club that had been sitting for a while, and they had the stage and all that. So we went in there, we were rehearsing, we had all of our stuff set up, and after a couple of nights of rehearsing there, we'd left one night and found out that the place had burned down that night. Lost everything, $20,000 worth of equipment gone in one night, and that was Park Music's equipment.
Was the equipment insured?
No.
So who was supposed to replace the equipment?
We went back to Park Music and told them the story, and they contacted Sun and said that one of the bands that they were supporting had lost all their equipment in fire. So they said, bring all the equipment back to our factory and we will replace it. So me and Frank Cox loaded up everything into the van, drove all the way to Washington or Portland, Oregon, brought the stuff back to the factory, set it on their dock, and waited 2 days. And finally they said, no, we have problems, so why don't you guys head back to Minnesota? So we led back to Minnesota without equipment, and it was never replaced.
That's a long way to drive.
We drove all the way out there and all the way back and had nothing. So we came back, and Mort and Leo felt bad about the whole thing, so they set us up with Custom, which was another one of their sponsors. They'd contacted them and says, would you support this band and give them all their equipment, all their PA stuff? We used Custom for one night and gave it back to them and said, we can't do it.
Why?
It just didn't sound right. It wasn't right at all. And what happened then, I think we went to Torps Music in South Minneapolis and ended up with Marshall. Lonnie got a couple of Marshalls, and I got a couple of Marshalls. But we had a big tab we had to pay on that one, which after a while got repossessed and called back.
I'm getting confused between the fire and the truck accident.
Oh,
didn't
the truck accident.
Did they fix things for the fire, but not for the truck? Or did they fix it for the truck and not for the fire?
You're right. There was a truck accident after the fire. We lost it again. And then we rolled.
Because I was jealous. They got fixed, but nobody fixed me.
Yeah.
So you got a new set of drums at some point?
No.
Well, I did, but I didn't have insurance to cover it.
You had to buy a new set of drums.
Yeah.
What did you buy?
I bought a new set of Rogers, and I got those through Jim Lopez at B-Sharp Music, and he took very good care of me.
Okay, and speaking of musical equipment, what kind of bass are you playing at this time, Denny?
I'm playing a Guild. Well, actually, are we before the fire or after the fire? Well, actually, I was playing a Guild. I was playing a Guild the whole time, before and after.
What's Lonnie playing for a guitar?
Gibson, 335.
Okay.
He took his home that night. He didn't lose his in the fire.
Now, Denny, talking with you earlier, you said just by chance, in June of 1969, the band was traveling through Illinois and wanted to stop by and check out Blue Cheer at a concert, and something very interesting occurred. What's the story?
Yes, we were all on the road that time, which I mean by all is Dave Anthony was traveling with us. We were doing a bunch of shows through Iowa and Kansas area, and we came up into Illinois, and we knew that Blue Cheer was going to be playing at the Joliet Fairgrounds. So we'd pulled in there, and we wanted to see Blue Cheer play, and bought our tickets, parked our stuff outside, and walked in and sat down and waited and waited, and the opening act played, and they were done, and then we waited and waited, and Dave Anthony wanted to find out what was going on, so he went backstage and talked with the promoter, said he was told that Blue Cheer had not shown up and didn't know where they were. So Dave Anthony says, well, I got my boys out here if you want them to play their three-piece band. So the guy says, I'll take anything at this point because I'm getting all the restless kids out there. So we ended up playing the job for Blue Cheer, or filling in for Blue Cheer, who didn't show up. And Pete, you want to elaborate on anything that happened at that point?
Well, it was surprising. We were really apprehensive as to just how the crowd would react to another three-piece group coming on. However, we explained the situation, started playing, and it went really well. And as we closed the set, we did do the Eddie Cochran song that they had recorded, and actually it went pretty well.
Yeah, Summertime Blues. Yeah, we did that.
Summertime Blues was their huge hit.
Yep.
Obviously, you were introduced as Joker's Wild.
Oh, yeah. We were all upright and straightforward about it. And
you made no attempt to pretend you were...
And I think my take, anyway, Denny might disagree with me, but my take was that the crowd was just thrilled that someone, after the silence, was up there and providing some music for them.
Yep. And they even offered to give people money back, but they didn't. They just stayed and had a good time.
Was that a freebie?
No, everybody paid to get in there.
Do you think some of the audience actually thought you were Blue Cheer?
I thought so. I mean, on a few people, they're saying, play your hit or play this, you know, they're yelling that. They didn't even hear us say that we were somebody else.
Had you played Summertime Blues before?
No.
Never? Well, how did you know how to play it?
It's a three-chord song. Just knew the song. We could...
You know, that was one thing about being a three-piece group playing with Lonnie Knight that was fabulous. We could play a song that we've never rehearsed. If someone knew the words to it, we could do it. I can remember several occasions when Lonnie would turn around to the drums and say, we're going to play, and he'd spit out a song name and start counting 1, 2, 3, 4 for it to start.
And once it started, you just followed it.
I can remember Shapes of Things to Come one night. It just came out of nowhere. We'd never rehearsed the song, never played it before, and it was just... We're doing it. 1, 2, 3, 4. Let's go.
I remember doing a show in Iowa where Lonnie came up with Hello, Goodbye by the Beatles, and we did that song. And I went, whoa, we did it.